Welcome, reanimated fans, to this week's podcast. I am H.A. Conrad with a scraggly voice today, coming to you from Brooklyn, along with my co-host. Sorry, I don't know what happened there. Along with my co-host, Stuart Tiffin, who is on the other coast. How are you doing?
Oh, man. What a time to be alive. Am I right? Good.
But on to...
We have one miserable piece of Walking Dead news, and there's not a lot else out there. Did you see the story that was rating all the George Romero films, 7 through 1?
Yeah, I saw that too, but I was like...
It was kind of too obvious. Guess what? Night of the Living Dead is everybody's favorite. Still is.
Yeah, no kidding.
Okay, so the piece of news, that's in quotes, that's in serious air quotes, is that the reason why Daryl Dixon rides a motorcycle, according to... this is actually a gem dropped from Jeffrey Dean Morgan's Instagram show that he does with his wife, Hanging with the Morgans, I think is what it is. apparently, Daryl Dixon is scared of horses, or he doesn't trust them, which is just a more manly way of saying he's scared of horses. And in season one, there he was supposed to be in a horseback chase or ride. Yep. Or maybe season two, whenever he first got on a motorcycle. He was like, whose motorcycle is that? And they were like, oh, that's Merle's. And he's like, well, if Merle can ride a motorcycle, so can I. And he talked his way into not having to ride horses, which is starting to be a bit of a stretch in the post-gasoline era, I guess. But
unless he finds some kind of solar battery or something. I don't know, man. But no, I can see. But you know what? It makes you think, I'm fine with horses, but they are pretty, they can be temperamental and depending on the situation can be super dangerous.
They're big animals.
They're big animals and they can spook. And so I get that. And especially given how much they use them in the show, I can see why this is a thing. So I don't blame him too much for that. But it is kind of funny that his sort of one of his little key character, accoutrement is because he's scared of horses. So. And especially because he plays such a tough guy. But you can be tough and you can be sensitive. You can have fears. It's all right. Do you want to jump into talking about... I know this is such a small news week. There was nothing really
there's not, there's
out there.
There's nothing out there.
Yeah. Do you want to jump into our next couple of recaps, reviews of the
Deadlands? I will after I make one other observation, which is the absence of news about Walking Dead is almost newsworthy. The fact that they're still not talking about when that finale is going to be aired.
Well, that's concerning.
Why
to me too.
Is that?
I know. It's not a
good thing. The Dungeons & Dragons live streaming show that I watch a lot called Critical Role, they went back into the studio this week. I think I might have missed that if they canceled it, but yeah, they did their live show. People are doing production in LA, and I know LA is not Georgia, but I know that they've been doing it in Georgia longer, so I'm just a little curious. Anyway, let's talk about...
I think we've talked about this before, but did you watch Mythic Quest, the Raven's Banquet?
Yes. Well, I watched a couple episodes.
And you weren't into it? Really? I figured you would be
video games, right? Yeah, but it's, I think...
I love it.
That dude plays such unlikable characters. What's his name?
Oh,
Always Sunny.
Rob McElhenney, whatever, however you say it.
Yeah,
that.
And I just find it difficult to watch sometimes, that's all.
Yeah, but the woman who plays Poppy, her name is Charlotte Nickdow, is amazing. Mm-hmm. She is incredible. Plus, you've got Murray F. Abraham. Anyway, sorry, I digress. Let's talk about the Deadlands.
Very well. Deadlands, the episodes we're talking about today are Generational Warfare and A Question of Identity. These are episodes 5 and 6 for this season.
I have to say... that I'm really enjoying this series. I do think that overall I've been enjoying it, but I do think that some of the pacing and the storytelling maybe could have been tightened up a little bit. I don't know, but I am enjoying this, and I think that overall I think that the biggest and strongest part of this show is the chemistry between Waka and Mayhay.
They are the strongest, and then also they fall victim, or they are also as guilty because of, and this isn't the actor's fault, this is the writing, that they keep having this oh, I'm leaving. I don't trust you anymore. Yeah. Like, their bickering is just, like, three episodes in now, and I'm a little bit... It's right. Not, like, the fun part of their relationship. It is a little bit, because when she gives as good as she gets, that's fun to watch. But sometimes it's more of the more draggy kind, where he's constantly threatening to leave, and you're just like, dude, yeah. Waka, just go already. Oh, my God.
And so that's the only part that I'm kind of like, I'm not so wild about it, but I still really like the chemistry between these two. In this episode, basically, you know, now that they know the name of the person who broke the world, they have the little sort of cliffhanger that it's Waka's father. And they are journeying back to talk to Mehe's tribe. Mm-hmm. To tell them what has happened.
First, they have to leave Hine behind, although I thought she was going to go with them for a minute, and then it's like she changes her mind. But she drops some knowledge that Tane, the god of the forest, is fighting Wiro, the god of the underworld, and that's what's killing the land. And then after that, she's like, all right, peace. See you guys later. And they leave with Uri, who also splits off, and I'm not sure what his plan is.
Yeah, I don't know, but, you know, and then, you know, they do have a tender moment between Waka and Uri, which is kind of funny since he's been very anti-Uri up until this point. And then Mehe notices it, and it's because they're brothers or half-brothers.
That's right.
And one of the things that this episode, and actually, like, I started trying to do a little bit more research in general, was about the Maori mythology and the gods and stuff. And it's kind of interesting because it's got some unique qualities and stories, but it also has some common stories with, like, I mean, they've got Maui is still very much a part of their pantheon, and, you know, which is, you know, this very, you know, we all know who Maui is, or if you've seen Moana, you know who Maui is, maybe.
Maybe a version of Maui, before. Maybe.
A version of Maui. But what's interesting about it is that there is sort of like specific mythology stories, but within this show, they are also somewhat creating their own mythology, or they're like adding stories in to sort of push their story along. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
I found a bunch of videos after watching doing last week's podcast, and I put them in the show notes, and I'm sure you haven't had time to look at them all, but a lot of it talks about, like, how this is a mythical world and not based on their actual legends.
Yeah, and I mean, I think not that there was confusion, but you and I, when we were talking initially, we were both like, oh, is this person supposed to be, or this god supposed to be someone we know? Yeah. Is this something sort of specific? And, you know, as I'm like a dorky mythology person. Like, I really like all the different mythologies. It's probably why I loved American Gods so much. And, like, I think all of the sort of, I think the most interesting thing is the commonalities between a lot of the different mythologies. And you'll see, like, sort of common themes to stories which are trying to explain various like, you know, phenomenon in nature and life and death and all of that. And the commonalities are much more interesting than the differences, although the differences are really cool too, depending on where people are in the world. Japanese mythology, totally dark, man. It's like, there's just like all their folk tales are like terribly creepy and upsetting. Ghosts are evil in Japanese mythology.
That explains a lot about their horror genre.
Yeah, it's pretty dark. I remember those sort of I think my dad gave me a whole book of that when I was like in elementary school, because I was that weird little kid, and remembered like staying up all night because I was like terrified to go to bed because of the ghosts or whatever they were in this particular mythology book or whatever. But in any case, I didn't see maybe the videos you put up, but I did see an interview with somebody else and talking about how they basically have created a very specific world, and that this was not necessarily something that was traditional, though they did base it on some traditional folklore and stories. Yeah. So that definitely made a lot more sense, knowing that this is just trying to be a new thing. So so they're not sort of following a specific, and I mean, Waka himself felt like he must be some kind of a, like, maybe he was like sort of a demigod or something like that. And
that's, I mean, they certainly do a great job. If he's not a known entity in Maori, like, you know, culture or mythology, they certainly do a great job of making like him feel that way, because people react viscerally when they find out what his name is. And that happens in the second episode we're talking about,
like,
today.
I very much thought he was like a Hercules-like character. But
like an evil Hercules, bizarro Hercules.
Bizarro Hercules. But in any case, you know, we've got the pacing in this particular episode, which I'm somewhat complaining about, is just, you know, I think we kind of have the sort of, the jump back to Mehe's family and,
in between, before they can get there though, Waka, and I've already kind of bitched about this, but Waka is like, I'm done with you. I'm not going to see your cave. Yeah. I'm taking you to the Pa, I think. And then by the next episode, he's like, I'm not going to the Pa. he keeps flipping because every time he goes to the afterlife, he gets given some advice and he starts to follow it, because apparently he's just as easy to lead as a, you know, a very gullible leady thing.
But yeah, and they have like that kind of thing where they're both walking on their own, and then.
But he's basically following her, and then saves her from some zombies when she gets caught out at night. But they do eventually get back to the cave, and things have been going badly back at the ranch. And we actually had a cutscene where the shaman who's tied up in the cave where Mahia used to be hears an attack happening. And that might have even been the cold open for the episode. I'm not sure when that scene I don't remember when that scene happened. But he's just there, like, looking forlorn. And then Rangi Mehe's mother's name is. But they all come in and they're like, oh, things are bad. They're coming from the tunnels. And the shaman is like, I'm not going to tell you where those tunnels are or how to close them, because that's my knowledge and that's my leverage and you'll have to let me go. And that kind of sets up the drama and the story for this episode.
Yep. And it is kind of like, you know, I did like how they set up the whole fact that they're in the tunnels and that they're kind of coming through, and you know, it's like, the setup I thought was very good, and I do think that it was successful in that they definitely made it terrifying. And it's, I don't know, the horror of sort of like what the people are dealing with and having these things come into what they thought was a safe place. And, you know, and then the horror of the fact that mainly the people are taken by the dead are the kids, which is kind of like,
They lose half of their adults. Presumably we only see like one guy lying on the ground, but Rangi tells Mehe when she gets back, she's like, he's like, we lost half our people. Also, they took the kids, and Mehe at first is like, breaks down. Waka gives her like a pat on the back. Actually, that whole scene where everybody kind of circles around Mehe as she's freaking out about this doll she's got. And then Waka's like, Mehe, be strong. And you never see him be like, I don't know, give her advice, or I guess he does give her advice a fair amount. But I haven't seen him be like that before, a little nurturing.
Right. And I mean, we also see the importance of the children in this case, which we had not.
They're like very communal feeling. They're like everybody's kids. Yep. Thought that was kind of
interesting. Well, and I also think it's not clear whether some of these kids are actually hers. And I do think there's some undertones of other relationships with Mehe. And she makes a couple of comments in this series because, like, you know, so I don't, like, they very much. I don't think that there is any shipping of Waka and Mehe, or at least that's not my read.
There's a
on
funny,
it, although
there's
they
a
do.
Funny scene in this episode where she's like, you don't think that I would with you. And he's like, well, I see how you look at me. And she says she would rather sleep with Hine, the witch.
Yep. Well, Hine is pretty beautiful, so I don't blame her.
But that was mostly just a way to spite Waka and his hubris at that point. But that was a funny scene. Again, they continue with that. That's like the high notes of their relationship, is when they do fight. And she generally gets the upper hand and has the last word.
Right. I guess the one part is that sort of they get this. She gets the support of her tribe, but then they kind of turn on her in that she's like, we need to rescue the children. And it's weird to me because they've put such faith in her, you know, and they've shown her support, and then suddenly they don't. And I find that shift to be somewhat unbelievable, just given where they are at this point. And they're basically like, oh, no, the kids are dead.
It's, you know? It's complex because she had challenged the shaman uncle for leadership of the tribe. And then the first thing she does is take off and go find the witches. So leaving them leaderless, Rangi might have taken over again. But Rangi's actually the one who's done a complete 180 and is like, you're my boss. I love you. You knew that dad was alive and I didn't believe you. And because of that, now I'm going to do whatever you say. And I'll follow you anywhere. And it's her mom who ends up betraying her to Shaman Uncle in this episode because she doesn't want Mehe to give up her womb. It's a bit twisted by modern standards, but it would make sense it 100% makes sense in the context of this story. She's like, think about how many women are left who can even have babies. Cause she's thinking like, half the tribe is gone and all the children are gone. So we have to rebuild, and Mehe, you're going to have to get to work on that. Like that's the argument. And it makes sense in the context, but it's obviously by modern standards kind of messed up.
Do you want to jump into was there anything else we need to cover within this episode?
So a couple of little details. They get into the caves. Waka is thrown into the cave to be lit on fire by the shaman uncle, which is, I think, the second time he's tried to kill Waka. Mehe is freed by Rangi and Tui and this girlfriend who I don't know what her name is. Have you ever caught that?
I don't remember her name.
She's in every scene that involves the tribe, and she's obviously Mehe's best friend and she, at the end of this episode.
Or Mehe's girlfriend. Oh, potentially,
yeah. So they get into the caves. They find Waka. Tui gets got. Poor Tui. But he was third in line, and so that was inevitable. Also, he always felt a bit like a sacrificial pawn character. And then when they find this like central chamber where all the zombies are, there's some new zombie behavior that is worthwhile pointing out, which is that their eyes go white. True. And at least during the day, their eyes go white. They're kind of like I Am Legending. They're standing there breathing. Yeah. And they only really react to noise and a little bit to light because they look at the torch at one point, but then they don't really do anything about it. But when Waka steps on something sharp and says, eat my shit, really loud, and it echoes to the whole cave, then they all wake
and
up.
And they react. Yeah,
that was funny.
I also, the other behavior is that, and I don't remember the name of this particular warrior, but this is the one who basically we saw being sacrificed by Mehe's uncle, or the shaman, rather, sorry. Was it her uncle or the shaman
uncle?
Shaman uncle guy, whatever he is. And this is the one that we saw who seemed to have some knowledge of what was happening. And he has actually been protecting the children, and they saw this sort of weird protective stance with some of the zombies, but specifically him. Allows her to be able to rescue the kids.
What's super confusing is they call him Tane, which they had already earlier in this episode established as the name of the god of the forest. So in opposition to Wiro, like that to me is like you could have picked a different name for this guy unless this is on purpose. You're trying to say that.
I mean,
people get named after gods all the time. That's fine. But I feel like doing that in the same episode it just confuses this dummy.
Right, unless you're going to follow up on it, which they don't.
Well, they don't?
And then...
Okay. I wasn't sure. You don't see Tane zombie die, so I wasn't sure if he was going to show up again later.
No, they don't address it. And, you know, but I will say that the fight scenes within the tunnels, super claustrophobic.
Really good.
There's also the other part, which is the fire part, which is really just freaky and upsetting and again, claustrophobic. And
screaming of the children.
I did, like... I did love the action sequences. I thought they did a great job with filming this within the sort of narrow confines of these tunnels, and they made it feel really terrifying. And then when they got the kids out, there was like that moment with the tribe, which are like, oh, I guess you're right, Mehe.
They don't what I think is missing here is her mom just like takes the children.
Kind of it, like matter
takes
of fact,
it all in stride instead of being like, oh my God, you were right again. I should never have done this. I shouldn't have betrayed you. Of course, Shaman Uncle tries to kill Waka a third time by trying to throw a torch into the hole. But Rangi, who is now my favorite dude, takes the torch away from Shaman Uncle, throws him down the hole. And then Waka totally bowls him over, which was another... That looks really physical scene.
It's physical, and the choreography there was great. I thought that was fantastic. And then Shaman Uncle gets caught in the tunnel in the trap that he had tried to set for Waka. And, Rongi is definitely my favorite turnaround character in this, because he was really annoying at the beginning, and now he is redeemed.
He was super obnoxious. So, I love me a good arc. I mean, and Waka is going through one, too. Meihei is, too. Rongi, Waka, Meihei, Tui's arc abruptly ended, but he was kind of cool the whole time, so... Where was he going to go but down?
Yep. So, and then, you know, they get to the end of this episode, which is where they basically say they've got to go and deal with the person who broke the world.
Which everybody knows is his dad, except, well, Meihei doesn't know that yet. She learns. When does she learn that?
I thought it was the next episode, but maybe it's at the end of this. I don't remember. Because I feel like it is
the next episode. Yeah, it's not that long into it. But he goes into the afterlife like twice an episode now, I feel like. And each time he is told something that changes his behavior when he gets back to the world. And I mean, this is good for storytelling, but it's also like, all right, which way is he going now? Because once again, at the end of this episode, he talks to the man who I think he calls Ka. One time
he does call him Ka,
and Ka tells him like, hey, you know, you better go see Te Kaipo, who is the king and Te Hao's boss and his father, and like Meihei is going to be really important to him. And based on that interaction, and maybe I'm missing something really significant, he like at the beginning of the next episode is once again, he's like, I'm not going to take you to Te Kaipo. And they're threatening to not hang out again. And so it's just, this is like the yo-yoing I find a little bit difficult.
Yeah. The yo-yoing is a little bit much. And the next episode, I think, is we find out a lot more about Waka.
Yeah, because he starts with a cutscene of him as a little boy. That's a good scene.
Yep, and it's a good scene. And I mean, look, they've kind of painted. I mean, they've been, leaving big clues and things all around that Waka isn't exactly what he seems, and there's a lot of what built him into what he is today. And you know, the big sort of storyline for him is that he is the, basically the bastard son of his father, who is apparently a pretty powerful person. He's a sorcerer, and the chief of whatever the tribe is. And there is, you know, we find out a lot in this episode about that, but, you know, to sort of, and this is like spoilers or whatever, but basically he was treated very differently from the other children, even though he basically is doing sort of, in terms of like the type of training and stuff that the children are getting, he's generally the most successful at sort of dealing with the challenges that they put in front of him.
Of course, they really underscore his lone wolf tendency, where he's just like, hey guys, let's try avoiding the zombie, the demons or whatever this thing that is that they're out there in the woods to fight. And no, they're like, let's all team up together and fight it when, you know, on our own terms. And he's like, screw you guys, I'm out of here. And then he manages to evade for the longest. But all he gets for his troubles is a bunch of slaps.
Right. And I mean, I think this also sets up the relationship with his dad, the comments that he's made to his ghost mother in the afterlife flashes, his visits. She was basically enslaved by his mother was enslaved by his father. And he is the product of that enslavement union, and so basically is not treated like an equal, definitely not treated as a son. He even calls his father father, and his father says no, like, that's not what you call me. And so there's a lot that's set up there, and you know, it's so this is basically sort of just the setup before they like go into this village, about, you know, where he is in his mindset and how he feels towards him. And I think it also sets up what you think about that particular character before walking in to the village.
I think we also get a scene of him going to talk to his mother in the afterlife at the beginning of this episode, where he effectively manipulates her for the first time, because he calls her on the goat, the goat piss thing, kind of revealing to her that he's got another dead guy that he talks to, but doesn't tell her who. And also manages to get her to agree that he should go to the Pa, as he calls it, to Kaipo's village, by saying, you know, I'm going to get revenge. And that kind of like really gets her going. And she's like, yeah, let's do that. So he kind of turns that around on her. And then when he comes out of his trance or whatever, Mehe is there. And she's like, wait, oh, okay. So she kind of hears... She can overhear at least half of the conversation, which is kind of hilariously paralleled at the end of this episode, too, when he's having an altercation / interaction with Ka and he's getting his ass kicked. And you only see it from Mehe's perspective. And it's just like he's getting contorted and like losing a fight to the air from her perspective. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. I also think that this episode definitely sets up the fact that, you know, like the unreliable nature of whatever these ghosts are, whatever these spirits are, is definitely, you know, they, especially like his mom and Ka now, whatever his name is, his mom reacts very, very violently when she hears that he's been talking to somebody else. And it sets up this thing where it's like, well, who do you trust? Do you trust Ka? Do you trust his mother who's been trying to kill Mehe?
Clearly he trusts Mehe, and I think that's the only person he trusts.
Yeah. And, you know, you hear Mehe questioning sort of the demands, and she basically calls him out on the request that his mom has made of him. And so there's a lot of like sort of this spirit stuff. It's like, is it good? Is it bad? Like, it's kind of weird. And then Ka keeps he's made several comments about how important Mehe is. And so there's that too. So it's sort of like you, like as the viewer, it's you just definitely feel like maybe he'd be better off not going into the spirit world at all.
Right, but sometimes they pull him out of the normal world, like when he's sleeping, which is always funny. Yeah. When he wakes up and his mom's poking him with a spear, and she's like, "Is this?" Anyway, it's just funny. So the village, is not a welcoming place. Lots of heads on sticks. Uh-uh. And it also just feels like there's not a lot of people there, and it's also a scene shot in the rain, so that adds a bit of English to it.
Mm-hmm. And as they come into this, they've also sort of made an agreement that they're not going to talk about who Waka is, and Waka is on board with that, but then they kind of get that plan doesn't go so well, because I cannot remember the name of the guy, but
Teho's buddy.
Yeah, Teho's buddy kind of like outs him, and you know, it's, you know, when they walk into the village, it's sort of like Waka's father is older. I mean, he's an old man, and I don't know if he's like, I wouldn't say that it's obvious that he's changed necessarily, but he does seem to be a little bit more mellow than what we had seen in what we had witnessed in the first scene. And, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know. I just kind of feel like the way that they set up the scene is such that I think it is a little bit of a misdirect. I think that this is a little bit of what they're setting up here, is that they're trying to make you question whether the father has changed. He's still a sorcerer. He's definitely, he's not completely coming out with exactly what happened, but seems to be somewhat on board with trying to fix what has happened. So there's a lot that's kind of going, I feel like the audience is kind of questioning whether Waka's reality or Waka's impression of his father is the right one. And basically he's already promised, Waka's already promised his mother that he will kill his father. And
from what we've heard, that's completely legit. Like this guy, his father killed everybody in his tribe except his mother. And then, you know, did what he did to her. This is an unredeemable character. And just because we end this episode kind of on a good foot with him, I don't think the audience is supposed to feel that they trust him, just based on the all the groundwork right. that's been laid.
Right. But I think they do their best to try to sort of set that
yeah,
up.
Yeah, they
right?
do.
And you do get the sense of his power. You get the sense well, of...
He knocks out Waka with just some powder, right? Like, because Waka right. Can't help himself. He's such a blockhead sometimes. And he tries to kill his father as soon as he sees him the next morning. And then and right. his father just, you know, disarms him or whatever and is about to cut his head off. Meihei then gets... It's like kind of a standoff. And then... Yeah. To Kaipo's wife is the one who is like, wait a second, this guy's your son? He could be the solution to our problem here. And then they work their way into the quest, which is go inside the nasty cave and clean it out of all the zombies. Yeah. There are a few dozen zombies in that cave. And we also heard that Teiho had 40 warriors with him when they went to find Uri. And you get the impression that this village must have been jam-packed before yeah. all this stuff went down, because wow, there are it only feels like there's about 6 people in the village most of the time,
right? And I mean, I do like, again, I like the teamwork with Meihei and Waka in this. Like, they're both like kind of psyching each other up to like take care of this, and don't, you know, and that's, you see their teamwork here in a way that I think, you know, even though they had been kind of fighting and bickering and doing their thing, ultimately these two trust each
other. It's so heartwarming, because right outside the cave, he's like, I'm better off alone. And then they get inside the cave and the door is closed and he goes, we're stronger together. And I totally had like get up and cheer kind of moment. That felt really good.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad that they set up the whole thing where they're not trying to ship them, where they're like really partners.
Yes.
And as opposed to making them a romantic relationship. And so it's this very pure kind of relationship between the two of them, and trust between the two of them that they don't appear to have with anybody else. And they are like a badass fighting team. I really loved these scenes. And I also really loved when they emerge from the cave and they've totally taken care of business.
Covered in blood.
Because like the, Waka's father and the other people in the tribe definitely did not expect them to emerge.
Waka also had to remember, he had to do a unarmed zombie kill to even prove that he was worthy to go into the cave and kill like 20 more zombies. And the move he does, like that arm lock followed by a head stomp, very cool. Just nice choreography. And then to have Meihei be the one with the solution, like the tactical solution to how they beat the zombies, which is lure them into a narrow crevice, which hilariously Waka gets stuck in and almost eaten, right? I love the fact that the writers and the actors do a great job with the physical and the dialogue acting. Just the show continues to give me these enjoyable morsels, but especially between Waka and Meihei.
Right. And I mean, I think there's also this satisfaction, or at least satisfaction I felt when you watch. I mean, look, the beginning of this episode is Waka's father to Kaipo basically being dismissive of his son, treating him terribly, and for them to come out victorious and basically sort of shocking his father and the others. There is definitely a satisfactory moment of like like there is just like a self-satisfied kind of thing going on, because it's like you want to see, like, this is the great thing about the character of Waka, is that despite he's definitely a bit of an anti-hero, but you are forced to like him despite his weaknesses and despite his drawbacks. And Meihei tends to bring out the better parts of him, which we have seen. And so to have them come out victorious after they were thrown into what appeared to be a completely sort of unwinnable situation, there is a satisfactory little moment there where they are sort of like, well, this is what we do, and they're confident in each other. So that's kind of cool, too.
It is both satisfying and also kind of, I don't know, there's like a edge of disappointment in me to this, because what does he have to prove to his father? And that's right. almost like, yeah, it, I mean, on the one hand, he's getting recognition from this guy who's treated him like dirt his entire life. And is that a good thing, really? I mean, no, in a way. But yeah, so I feel a little bit conflicted about how when he comes out victorious and his dad's like, maybe you were sent here for a reason, boy. Like, that's the nicest thing his dad's ever said to him, which is also still a real backhanded, not compliment. And yeah, I think Tekaipo can't get his comeuppance fast enough. And when they come out and Tekaipo's also like, well, you cleared the... Okay, so they're like, go in there and get your work done. He's like, oh, there's lots to do before we get to that point. And I'm like, oh, okay, now he's just, you know, he's equivocating. He's slowing down. He's sandbagging. He didn't expect him to come out alive. And now he's got to figure out what he's going to do next. So not feeling super great about that. Definitely have a lot of feels for Waka in this situation. And then the episode ends with that conversation he has with Ka, and Meihei overhears him say, I was dead. You resurrected me to do this mission. And she has kind of an epiphany, but we don't know. I don't know. You might know. I don't know where she's going to go with that information. But to me, it kind of sounded like, wait, you were resurrected and then now we have a zombie plague.
Yep.
So it does kind of feel like he might be the key.
Or you were resurrected and, you know, because her kind of consistent mantra has been, you don't trust the dead. Well, he is not alive.
Right.
Or he is brought back. So it's just like a different mechanism. But yeah, I think that there's definitely that's going to be something that she will have to deal with. And so, yeah, to me, the themes of this episode, especially with Waka and his father, are like, look, I mean, I think you can certainly translate this into normal terms, but, you know, he's got a lot of daddy issues. This has been something he's struggled with his entire life. He's, even though his father has treated him terribly, he still wants his approval desperately. And so I think that the fact that they were able to bring this into it in this fashion and in under these circumstances is kind of, and within the sort of, you know, the rules of the tribe and the different things that they respect, I thought that was kind of a cool thing. And I think, well, anyway, but I know more because I've watched the whole thing, but, let's put that pause on that discussion until the last two episodes of this series,
which we will come to, next time. So yeah. I will say, like, these two episodes were a lot better than the last two that we talked about, which I felt like the pacing was too slow. You know, that exorcism just went on for days. These two, we've got great action scenes. We've got some great action scenes and dramatic notes in this sixth episode. So 100%, like, two thumbs up. These were good for me.
Yeah, no, they were definitely a little bit better. I think, as I said, the only thing that I'm like kind of like about is sort of the back and forth between Meihei and Waka, because, look, they trust each other. I think you can just leave that be. You don't have to constantly be pushing this sort of back and forth between them. I think there's ways to show that without sort of having them just sort of display it in such a ridiculous fashion, because they're much past that point. And I think that they, part of why they were doing that is to get to that really triumphant end scene with them in episode six. But I think that, there were better ways to tell it, I guess, at that point. But in any case, overall, I like these two a lot more than I liked, the pacing of that last episode, before these two. And so, looking forward to the finale of this series.
Yeah, cool. So, hit us up. If you're watching this and you have some thoughts, let us know. You can send us an email at reanimatedpodcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at reanimatedpcast, and our show notes are on the internets at reanimatedpodcast.com.
Hey, until next time, thanks for listening.
Thanks, bye.